Hi, thank you for joining us for the Rethink podcast. My name is David, and I'm the editor of Think Magazine.
And I'm Nika, researcher and project manager at the University of Malta and a writer for Think Magazine. The internet and social media are a hallmark of modern society. A plethora of tools exists to help us consume, create, edit, and curate the swaths of data available at our fingertips. But how has this renaissance of information affected younger generations? Are children more adept at navigating cyberspace? Or are we the ones who need to rethink cyberculture? Dr. Vela Slava Hillman is a researcher at Data, Media, and Society Research Center, Malta, and a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. Throughout her research, she has reinforced the need to voice children's and young people's perspectives and experiences. Welcome, Veleslava Hillman.
Thanks so much for having me.
To get us started, I'd like to ask all of us a little question. How do we use digital media? I mean, me personally, I tend to use digital media constantly, not just as part of my work, but I guess even in the morning, the first thing I do when I wake up, check Facebook and Instagram.
How do I use media? I use it primarily, yeah, obviously to connect, to share, to check up information. What I do as a social scientist, I tend to really try everything that I plan to research. So I've tried video games. Obviously, I engage with kids and young people. So whatever they are using and, you know, engaging with, I tend to do research around that. I don't use that much social media, but what occurred to me when I read your question initially was it would have been interesting to get people's initial reactions when they first encounter social media like Facebook. What was your very first reaction? I remember signing up for Facebook, and I was really excited about it at first, and then I thought there's something weird about it. So I tried it. I shared some images at the time when images couldn't be removed from Facebook, if you remember that period, which really scared me. Yeah. And eventually it took even longer for me to break up from that affair. It was like a 2-week affair, and then it was even a longer affair to break off. You know, the initial experiences were like really shocking. And what I also wanted to add to this question is, you know, the first engagement is always excitement. And even when you research with children, young people, you see the excitement, but then the relationship changes. So you want to check what happens eventually when habituation sets in. And when suddenly technologies become almost invisible to us, and how they become really immersed with our life. And that's when you really want to weigh in what are the benefits, what are the risks there.
Well, I would say that I, for a while, had a Facebook addiction, so that was sort of my go-to platform. Luckily, I avoided other media such as Twitter and Instagram because I felt that if I got onto those, I would end up with another addiction. But I have gotten myself off Facebook recently, so I think it's just once you get on it, it's really hard to just completely remove. I remember, you know, being on MySpace and stuff and being on media too much from the start, and I think probably a lot of people can relate to that. And thinking about that, because we started, David, as teenagers interacting with this stuff, but now it's children. So maybe, Veleslava, you could tell us, how do children use social media today?
Okay. First of all, there's a lot to unpack there. When we say children, who do we really mean? Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thinking that I always start off with. Who are those children? Where do they come from? How old are they? What families do they come from? Where do they live? What inspires them? What you know, what fears they have? So there's so much behind that. So we cannot really group, and there's a lot of danger that lies in grouping this way. I will just make some reference to Common Sense Media. They're quite a big organization. They do a lot of research, mainly in the US, but the figures are quite reflective of what's happening elsewhere, like UK and even in Malta. So let's say, generally speaking, now we see quite a lot of increase in overall use of digital media technologies, network technologies, social media, YouTube, from birth to 8 years old. So that's a very young cohort. So Common Sense Media, for example, they've looked at daily use range between 49 minutes among those younger than 2 to 2.5 hours. So, now, these figures also spiked tremendously during the COVID-19 pandemic. It was like a really, really drastic jump because we were on a lockdown, schools had closed and all that. So this changed this sort of new normal appeared. So I am quoting here figures that are in the normal, typical, any typical day rather than, you know, specifically for COVID period. And then for 2 to 4 year olds, you've got now a jump of 2.5 hours daily use and more than 3 hours for children aged 5 to 8. Now, at the same time, the complexity arises when you look at the different socioeconomic backgrounds. So you've got this digital divide that's still haunting us. And then you've got the other complexity of even if there is access, mere access is not really necessarily allowing us to engage fully and to fully benefit from technology. So there are those complexities as well. So we're talking about the skills, the competencies. And then you've got the teen, the preteen cohort. For example, on average, 8 to 12 year olds might be using just under 5 hours worth of entertainment screen media a day. And teens use an average of just about under 7.5 hours on a typical day. For the teens and preteens, for example, this has doubled only from the year 2015. Now, if you want to go even further in details and look at exactly what kind of media is being consumed, and I really dislike the term consume because it puts us in this group of we are one audience and we do one kind of thing, and it's not the case. But if you want to unpack again those terms, you see that, again, there are all these differences that start to vary from one individual to another. But yeah, there is a lot of media use, a media engagement in the different age groups.
Teenagers use digital media for 7 hours, whereas children use it for 5 hours. So I'm wondering, why is it that teenagers use digital media more than younger children? Is it a good thing that they use it more, or is it something we should be concerned about?
The why and the whether it's good to qualify it, these are two different questions. Now, why are they using a lot more than preteens? There are all sorts of reasons. And so when we say, but just the first thing to clear out, when we say teenagers use media on a typical day and they spend around 7 hours, let's be careful how we frame that. Mm-hmm. So we can't just, you know, say that every single teenager is using social media or is being on YouTube for 7 hours straight every single day. I mean, they will have exams, they'll have extracurricular activities and so forth. And, you know, things vary. This is an overall, this is a take with some kind of margin of error. But now the why consumption in terms of time varies from one age group to another. There are many factors. I mean, younger children will have perhaps, you know, more restrictions imposed on them. Older teens, for example, will have their own devices, whereas a younger child, a five-year-old, you know, will be using their parents' device. So there are all kinds of these variations. My thinking, though, is not so much as to, you know, why is there a difference between how much of it they consume? But I am interested in the quality of what exactly they do. And also in relation to other things that a child typically does and how a child feels. You know, if you are talking about just timing and saying, oh, 7 hours is just so scary and it's too much, without justifying exactly the quality of the activity during those 7 hours, then you might miss a lot of opportunities there. So a child may be immersed running a blog or doing something really creative, a project with their friend, which takes a lot of, you know, time.
It's very interesting what you said about kids, even before they're 2 years old, they're already getting exposed to this. I can only speak for myself as an adult, getting stuck on Facebook, for example, reading newsfeed. Obviously, a child that's going to be 2 years old is not going to be reading newsfeed. What are they reacting to? Are they actually able to navigate different pages, and do they have their own profiles? Because I know, for example, as well, some people will create profiles for their babies, they'll create profiles for their pets. Do they have access to their own profiles in that case?
My past research was really looking at what the opportunities are. What are the creative opportunities? So what does a child do with an application? What are the opportunities afforded by applications, by platforms, but from the child's perspective? I wanted to know both in terms of learning and in terms of self-expression. So I looked at how a child engages and what that means to them. And we were talking about, so in the article that I wrote, for example, I was talking about the selfie thing. To another, that may be vain, but to a child and to different individuals, taking a selfie could be considered a self-expression. It's an everyday creativity. It's something that you want to articulate just using a different medium. You use the technology of the language to express yourself, to articulate a thought. And the same way you do that through dance or through music or through a selfie, through a picture. So what I followed was 8 to 10 year olds. I wanted to see what they do with technologies, and at the same time, what are the limitations and the opportunities that technologies enable. Because it's one thing to use an application that provides this finite choice of components that you can just put together as a puzzle and create this image. And it's another thing to have this sandbox type of play where you can really express yourself the way you can express yourself through voice or through instruments. So the opportunities are first, obviously, for connectivity, for self-expression, for this student-led kind of learning. When I looked at it from in the school perspective, so formal learning spaces, I also looked at how the different factors, you know, emerge together and play a part in what the child can actually do with a particular medium. So, for example, in very teacher-led, very conservative kind of environments, obviously it's the teacher that decides what's going to happen, how the tool is going to be used, or what the child should be doing. The child follows the instruction. So there's that less freedom to really explore and to take leadership. And to me, that's important, that children have their agency.
I mean, this is a recurring theme in, I find it difficult to say this word, it's a recurring theme in pedagogies.
Pedagogies.
Thank you. That's the word. Ideally, as much as possible, teachers try to move towards student-led learning strategies. However, before we jump into education, I would really like to ask this question. Do you think there is a correlation, because we were talking about selfies and narcissism, do you think there is a correlation between selfies and a child's conception of self?
Well, it's not about thinking. I would look at evidence, what the evidence says. So I think it's one thing to have a correlation, and it's also another thing to get, and it's completely another thing to say that there is a causal relationship.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
And there, that tends to get missed when people look at the figures, you know, with some surveys. Mm-hmm. So in my research, I aim to unpack what is said from statements like the narcissism epidemic. You know, there was Jean Twenge from what university she was in the U.S. She wrote this a couple of books, The Narcissism Epidemic, Then Generation Me. But, you know, they're a bit outdated now, but I think that narrative persists still today. I don't necessarily agree with that. So when you have a conversation with someone, you learn a lot more the way they see things. And that's what matters a lot. So when you carry out a quantitative research and a survey, and you find out how things or what things, but you cannot necessarily understand as to why. That's where I tend to have a conversation with children, and even meet them in natural settings and try to understand how they view things and why would they do certain things. And that's why I have given an example in the article with the selfies, because I discovered a completely new view. Children basically wanted to share a funny face just to say hello to their friend. Or they wanted to compare things, or, you know, there's so much thought process going on out of a picture. And then the biggest shock is that you meet teachers, or parents. So you've got authoritative figures decision makers in a child's life who decide that this is not what it is. So there's that tension that emerges, and the child just wants to say something and they're not being heard. Just to mention that, but the other day we were in the bookstore with my youngest son. He's 8 now. Mm-hmm. And he comes to me, so I was looking at the books, and he comes to me and he says, "What does it take for a giant man to pay attention to me? I just want to ask a question." And it just melted my heart. And this is what it is. What does it take for giant people to hear children? I mean, we have to hear their version. You know, this persists a lot through, it's like the legacy of media effects theories, where audiences were considered very much a homogeneous element, and media exerts its control and effect over it with the same impact over every single member of that audience, and it's not the case. Now, children may not be able to articulate their thoughts verbally the way an adult might expect them to. Let's say they're in the classroom and the teacher, you know, already has an idea of what the right answer should be. And the child may not have been able to articulate that answer, but that doesn't mean that the child does not have an opinion or a view or an idea. We just have to see it the way they see it.
Yes, I actually found it really striking when I was reading your articles about the fact that we have such strong opinions about what digital media is doing to children, and we don't ask them, well, what is your experience? What is happening to you when you're using this media? What do you like? What don't you like? And it seems rather obvious that we should be doing that. So I'm surprised that we're not, and I think it's fantastic that you're doing this research. And maybe perhaps something else we should be doing is finding a way to better understand other forms of expression, because as you said, yeah, children are not going to be able to articulate themselves in the way that we do, but certainly we can make an effort to speak their language as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, of course, we need to follow the research method. We need to be carrying it, the right way. Obviously, a child will be excited about everything. So when you ask them, oh, they'll say they love everything. They're passionate about everything. Everything excites them. That's brilliant. Of course, we need to follow a methodology to understand better exactly what happens. So it's not that easy just to figure out exactly what the child thinks or what their perspective is. But it's just crucial, and especially in light of all the education technologies, especially coming into the classroom, and that's what my most recent research is about. AI, artificial intelligence and intelligence tutoring systems coming into the space, which are steering to have the capability to steer the learning process to really dictate what, why, and when and how a child should be learning something. And this is where we can really risk diminishing that space of the child to have choice, to have agency. Let's open up a little bit the discussion surrounding social media. Now, this is a completely different conversation than we actually have. My bigger concern with regards to social media is what a lot of research is pointing to, the echo chambers and this kind of hive mind that social media tends to create. Now, for example, following Cambridge Analytica scandal surrounding the last elections, U.S. elections, for example, and the surveillance capitalism of Professor Shoshana Zuboff, she's been calling on the international community to stand against this kind of data surveillance and data collection for rendition profiling and behavioral control. These are deep concerns that we should be thinking about and talking about a lot more. And that relates directly to social media and to also this kind of model where a lot of digital technologies, network technologies, including educational applications and platforms, are starting to follow the business model of extracting data for data profiling, prediction, and behavioral control. Now, when we talk about social media, we already have evidence to how this business model is impacting greatly and is, creating a lot of risks and raising a lot of concerns. So I'll give you an example. Do you know that only by the likes you have submitted on your Facebook account, developments in machine learning can help predict with great accuracy a lot about your personality, and with a high external validity of predicting life outcomes such as substance abuse, political attitudes, physical health, sexual orientation. This is a study that was done in 2013 by these by Kosinski, Stilwell, and Greppel, and then it was I think a similar one, or it was replicated in 2015. These guys, 2013, they demonstrated that just out of easily accessible digital records of behavior such as Facebook likes can be used to automatically and accurately predict a range of highly sensitive information that you may never have intended to share in the first place. Now, this is from a social media platform. This is a different conversation from the conversation we are having, or the research that I'm working on in the education space. Now, what's really disturbing, I just wanted to point this, but what's really disturbing is the fact that we share that data voluntarily, and we continuously do that, and children continuously do that. And this, you don't know what's behind it, what kind of data is being rendered, what kind of profiling is happening on a daily basis without your consent, without you even imagining how that data may affect you at some point. So books have been written already about it. Research has been done already about it. So these are the dangers from AI, from data extraction and data use for machine learning, for artificial intelligence. So these are the kind of things that I am worried about. And then obviously the second concern is the hive mind, which is a very big element when we talk about social media. So what's the hive mind? So we seem to become if you're constantly following the news feed on Facebook, and in fact, I found that in Malta, about 94%, this is the second highest user in Europe, is the Maltese population in Facebook. Only less than 10% of the Maltese population is not on Facebook. Now, we already know that social media algorithmically ranges what kind of information you're likely to view. It's interesting to know whether the general population knows, or the 94% of that population knows about this. So this kind of hive mind can be very, very dangerous, especially when you want to express an opinion, not even to express an opinion, but to actually say, look, there may be another side, another view to this. And now, you've heard about the cancel culture. So that's the power of the hive mind that worries me.
I agree. I think this discussion about the hive mind would be fascinating. However, I want to take it back a little bit. I feel that a lot of adults, they don't really realize how far a like can go. They don't realize that how easy it is to predict certain behavior patterns. But that being said, if adults aren't even aware, shouldn't we be educating children as well about this? Shouldn't children be exposed to social media at an early age with certain frameworks, of course, in place, so they can be more aware of how their data can be used, how it might be used against them, or...
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, and that's where education comes to crucial place. I created this media literacy education program for teachers, and I wanted to share it with teachers. I wanted to create workshops in Malta in February, March, before the first lockdown, and I've reached out to the Ministry for Education. I really wanted to create this conversation, at least to start the conversation, because it's not just about the teachers, the children. It's also about the teachers, so it's about all the different stakeholders in a child's life. So that whole social milieu that makes up the space where a child learns and grows up, we need to open that conversation about digital media literacy and education. From the question that you asked, I mean, all of that needs to be discussed a lot more openly with teachers, educators, educationalists, with parents, with children as well. I've looked at the digital media literacy and skills framework for the primary and secondary, for compulsory education in Malta, and there are so many things that we can do more. Data literacy, when we talk about data literacy, suddenly, this conversation from digital media literacy skills and competences has shifted towards data literacy. there is a lot that needs to be done at the local scene. A lot. Of course, it's very challenging to unpack that term. What do we mean by data literacy? Do we just show children what the data is and we just show them data sheets and say, well, this is what you can do with data? It's not that easy to decide and to build curriculum and pedagogy around it. But the first step, I believe, at least for the local context, is to start having the discussion about that. So I did a lot of research when I was a fellow at Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University last year. And I partnered with Cambridge Public School District. And I wanted to understand the kind of data that's being collected in schools. The granularity of data is just mind-boggling. It's so worrying in the sense that what happens to this data? Where does it go? Who's using it? Who's accessing it? For what purposes? All of these questions come out. And it's not just data that's generated by the school district or the school administrator, but it's also the platforms and the applications that are being used. So children today, for example, even in Maltese schools, they're using Microsoft Teams, they're using Google, they're using all sorts of applications on a daily basis. These are products, and these products require minimal amount of data and sometimes a lot of data in order for them to work properly. And at the same time, data is generated nonstop when the child is using this application. Where does this data go and how is that data used? So these are the kind of things that we need to talk about with children, about children, for children, through pedagogy, through curriculum, and also inform teachers as well. But not in a, you know, in a panicky way by saying, look, we can work on this together and we can build programs rather than panic people and worry people.
I mean, I think we can all agree that when we try and devise something out of panic, then we usually don't get the best results.
Well, I would love to keep this going. There's other questions I want to ask, and this is so interesting, but it seems like we're unfortunately going to have to wrap up. Veleslava, if there's any other last comments that you'd like to make before we end.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really love that. We should definitely continue the conversation. There's so much to say. There's just so much to say.
Yes.
If I have to say in one word, in a couple of words, is we shouldn't generalize and we shouldn't think of children as one homogeneous member of the population, but as many and very creative and very, very, very bright, creative individuals who have so much to say. We just need to hear them.
Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to hear the full version of this podcast, feel free to visit um.edu.mt/think.